to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lakeen. On July 4, 1776, members of the Continental Congress signed the Declaration of Independence, declaring, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," officially launching the American Revolution. In honor of our nation's birth, we have two segments on our show today. In the first half hour, we'll talk with Dr. Scott Stevenson from the exciting new Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. In the second segment, we'll talk with Dr. Colonel Sanders about taking care of our veterans who have fought to defend American freedom. The fight for American independence was fierce. It's an amazing story of courage and steadfastness in the face of seemingly impossible odds. Finally, we have a place that tells this amazing story in an exciting way. The Museum of the American Revolution just opened on April 19th in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, just steps from Independence Hall, where both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were created. Here to talk with us about the American Revolution and the new wonderful museum is Dr. Scott Stevenson, Vice President of Collections, Exhibitions, and Programming at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. Dr. Stevenson earned his Ph.D. in American history from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and is instrumental in the creation of the new museum. Dr. Scott Stevenson, welcome to All Together Now.
Well, greetings from the headquarters of the American Revolution, Philadelphia.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I have to say you have done an absolutely superb job of telling the story of the American Revolution in a compelling way, so congratulations.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so. Thank you so much.
Is it true that you spent about 10 years preparing for this museum to be created and helping shape and guide it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's just over about 10 and a half years now, yes, since I first walked into a nondescript brick building about 15 minutes west of Valley Forge Park, Pennsylvania, and it was filled with objects that had been pulled together over a century by the Valley Forge Historical Society, and this idea that we were going to build a museum to commemorate the founding of the nation. So it's been a fabulous journey full of many exciting discoveries and lots of twists and turns.
I'm sure. And what inspired you to devote 10 years of your life to helping create this museum?
Well, in fairness, they told me it was going to be about 2 years when I started, so, as with many things. Absolutely. Well, I'm a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and just was, you know, one of those people who came from a family with in this case, a grandfather who never took the highway anywhere, always drove the back roads and just filled me with great stories about things that happened at this crossroads and that crossroads. And so I just grew up with a love of history and eventually went to the University of Virginia for my PhD. And I did my dissertation on the French and Indian War, actually the period, the great global conflict between Britain and France that happened a decade and a half before American Revolution. And I had just done a large traveling exhibition to mark the 250th anniversary of that conflict, which established the city of Pittsburgh, which is where I'm from. And ironically, I was driving home from the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., from the last venue that the exhibit was appearing at, and I was actually kind of wondering, I wonder what I'll do next. I didn't have a firm plan in mind, and got a call 2 days later from some folks who were this kind of startup organization that had this incredible collection and had started raising money and wanted to build a museum. But they thought, we'll be open in 2 years, and 10 years later, we finally have been able to, cut the ribbon and had a fantastic ceremony on April 19th, which was, of course, the anniversary of the shot heard around the world at the battles of Lexington and Concord. And now it's jumped off of the computer screens and the paper that I've been looking at all these years, and is actually, you can actually walk through it now, and it's really amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. It's awesome. You've done a fantastic job. And like you, I grew up, my family was very big on American history, and I grew up in the greater Boston area in Massachusetts, which, of course, was instrumental in the American Revolution. And as you say, that's where the first actual shots of the battle took place.
Yeah, yeah.
And we make our yearly trek out to Lexington and Concord, where the shot heard round the world was fired that started the fighting aspect of the war. So I have been looking for years for a place that would actually tell the American story, because it's such an incredible story with so much, you know, courage and challenge and fighting and love and bravery and betrayal. It's just such a rich story with incredible characters. But really, there was nowhere.
You don't have to make anything up.
Right, exactly. It was really kind of amazing to me that we didn't have a place that told our story as a nation. But I'm so thrilled to find that you've created this Museum of the American Revolution. Now you tell the story of what happened. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. And I know that since you've been to the museum and being from Boston, you, of course, understand that the story we're telling is a very broad one. I mean, there's lots of Boston story that's in there, and Virginia, and the global story of the war. And yeah, I think, you know, we felt that what was missing, there's incredible museums. I mean, some that literally stretch back to the lives of the revolutionary generation, and institutions that have preserved objects and archives and buildings, and they tell parts of the story. But you're hard-pressed to find a place that you can kind of get the big, sweeping narrative that gives you a context. And so being able, I mean, literally two blocks from Independence Hall, we're right, but you go one block east toward the Delaware River, and there's the City Tavern where John Adams, you know, stayed throughout the Continental Congress and walked down the Chestnut Street every day on his way to the Pennsylvania State House. And there's, you know, across the street is Alexander Hamilton's, you know, first bank, the creation of our financial system. And right behind that is Carpenter's Hall, which was the site of the first Continental Congress. And, and then you walk another block and it's Independence Hall, and across the street and there's where Benjamin Franklin lived. It's just, it's incredible. And it's a city that, and a neighborhood in the city of Philadelphia that, as I said before, was the headquarters of the revolution. Almost every thread of the story passes through this neighborhood. I mean, on various dates during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Army marched down Chestnut Street right past the front door of the museum. The British Army marched down, you know, loyalists, the French Army. It's, all the diplomats, all the political and social history. It's just such a great place. And millions of visitors from around the nation and around the world already were coming here to Philadelphia. But what was sort of missing was the narrative that pulls that all together. So you now, if you start here at the museum and then go to Independence Hall, you know, then go to see the Liberty Bell, like you have some context for these incredible places and these incredible objects.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You've got the whole story told there and in a beautiful way, and I'm only jealous that Massachusetts didn't do it, but Philadelphia did it first.
Well, like I say, you know, we view ourselves, you know, very self-consciously, we build a museum that I like to describe as a visitor center for the American Revolution. And so, you know, we're trying to introduce visitors to all of those stories so that they will want to go visit places like Concord, for instance. And we mm-hmm. couldn't have done this without institutions like the Concord Museum there, which again has been collecting objects from the time in which people who lived during the Revolutionary War were still alive. And so in addition mm-hmm. to our own collection that includes things like George Washington's war tent, which I'm sure we'll want to talk about in some detail, having places like the Connecticut Historical Society, the Concord Museum, Colonial Williamsburg, you know, the Winterthur mm-hmm. Museum in Delaware, I mean, willing to share treasures that allow us to tell all of those stories. So we really do see ourselves as a place that we get people who are here in Philadelphia, but they're going home, or they're going to want to go to and visit those places and see the sites where all those things took place.
Right, exactly. And you talked about telling the narrative and the sweeping dramatic story, which you do so beautifully. And one of the things I loved in your museum is you ask some key questions, which when you think about it, they might be obvious, but, you know, no one had ever put it kind of so straightforwardly before. How did the colonists go from being loyal British subjects to raging revolutionaries fighting within about 10 years? So you can explain to our listeners, how did that shift happen?
Sure. So to introduce that, you know, we tried to take a page from successful science museums that I think are better in general than a lot of history museums in engaging visitors, in that case, in the scientific process. So a great example of that is you'll go to a natural history museum and the question will be, you know, dinosaurs, are they more like crocodiles or are they more like chickens, you know, and you, let's look at the evidence, and that introduces you to this idea that, you know, of science as a process. The same way, of course, we all know history isn't just picking up facts and displaying them on the wall, you know, interspersed with a few teacups and portraits. You know, history is a dialogue with the past. It's an ongoing conversation that we have with the past. It's informed by the questions that are relevant to us today about, you know, the evidence that survives, to try to understand, you know, the context, the cause and effect, for events in the past. So visitors to the museum, we've organized our core exhibition, which is 16,000 square feet, around four questions. The first being, how did people become revolutionaries? Then, how did the revolution survive its darkest hour? How revolutionary was the war? And finally, what kind of nation did the revolutionaries create? So for the first question, you know, how did people become revolutionaries? When you first walk into the exhibition space, we have you're in an immersive sort of round theater that you may remember. And we've created through live action, you know, actors and digital recreations, we put you into what is called Bowling Green, which is, if anyone's ever visited New York City before and you've been on Wall Street and you've had your picture taken by the bull on Wall Street, the little park that's right behind the bull has been known as Bowling Green since this was New Netherland in the 17th century. And the fence that surrounds that park is the original fence erected in the 1770s to protect a statue of King George III that was erected there, a great, huge, gilt lead statue that on July 9th, 1776, after the Declaration of Independence was read in New York, was torn down by a crowd of soldiers and sailors. And so we immerse you in that sort of messy, you know, populist scene of revolution. But then you push through a glass door and you step back 15 years to the end of the French and Indian War, where we talk to you about, you know, what it was like at that point when people we think of as revolutionaries, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, you know, others of that generation, John Adams, you know, were young men in a world in which they felt very patriotic about being part of the British Empire, part of the greatest empire, you know, since ancient Rome. And then the next sequence of galleries, we take you through, well, how did this all fall apart? You know, how did they go from winning this great, you know, global victory against France and Spain to then, you know, eventually tearing that same king down? And that will take you all the way to the story of the Declaration of Independence. You know, then we switch into kind of the core of the war years, and take you through that long slogging journey, and then eventually to the, you know, the creation of the United States Constitution and the early Republic and the fate of the revolutionary generation. Because one of the big ideas of this museum is to make sure people understand that the American Revolution and the Revolutionary War are not the same thing. You know, oftentimes we'll say American Revolution is kind of shorthand for an eight-year-long war. And while we tell a story that's largely set in wartime, by American Revolution, we mean the broader transformation, you know, of subjects of a monarchy to citizens of a republic, the changes that occur in society, you know, social, political, economic changes that come about. You know, our core story is about 30 years from 1760 to 1790, but then we continue on, and really in in the final media piece in the museum, we take you back to the spot, the Bowling Green, where you started, where you've seen a recreation of that statue of the king being toppled. But we went back there last fall and actually filmed in that park. And I was just there actually on the 4th of July to visit.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you can stand in that park in the middle of a fence that could not protect the king from the people. And today, that park is filled with people from around the world who are pursuing life, liberty, and happiness. And it is that big transformation that comes about because of the revolution. And as an experiment in self-government, we argue, you know, the American Revolution is still ongoing, and we really want people to come out of those galleries really feeling an energized sense of purpose. So actually the very last experience you have is you are walking down a hallway that is on one side of you. We have digitally recreated about 70 photographs from the mid-19th century of people who were alive during the revolution. Now, they may have been soldiers, they may have been children, they're women, there's one American Indian, there are a number of African-American people, some enslaved, some free, who we know who they were, and we can tell you a little bit about their lives. And then directly ahead of you are just a wall covered with mirrors with the simple words, "Meet the future of the American Revolution." And as you look at your face, as you're approaching those mirrors, all of those people are staring over your shoulder in your reflection. And we want to make sure, and you'll remember this from your visit, that we want to make sure that this is a living, vital presence in people's lives today. It's not just a quaint story that took place a long time ago.
Right, that's exactly right. I thought the ending was brilliant about, you know, here's the American Revolution today and seeing yourself in the mirror. So we're all need to be carrying on that tradition. But just so our listeners get the answer, that very first question you asked, which I love that you focused on the series of questions,
how did the colonists
go from being loyal British subjects to raging revolutionary? My takeaway and the simple answer is that after the French and Indian War, the British decided they needed to pay for the war, pay for defending the border and the boundary over in the American colonies, and thought it was very sensible that would be paid for, at least in part, by taxes on the American colonies, and that the colonists actually, it's not so much they objected to the taxes per se. What they most objected to was that they did not have a voice in those taxes being levied on them, and that was the no taxation without representation, and that as loyal British subjects, they felt they were entitled to have a voice in their representation if there were any taxes being waged. Is that a fair summary?
You did an excellent job. We would give you two gold foil stars on your forehead for coming away with that message. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and it was just such a great question because that's where it all started. And then the other question that I have been wondering literally for decades, most of my life, which you also raised, how did this group of colonists who were had their little ragtag group of army that was ill-fed, ill-clothed, with very limited weapons, how did they beat the most powerful military the world had ever seen?
Absolutely. No, you've nailed it. It is such an important question and very complex. And so, as you'll recall, as you go through that sort of second quarter of the exhibits, which basically, when you get to the end of how did people become revolutionaries, you actually encounter that statue of King George again. We've recreated him at full scale, so he's up on a pedestal. We have a life cast figure of a 18th century sailor who's standing there with a rope tied around the neck of the king, throwing it down to you as a visitor, inviting you to sort of weigh in on, well, what would you have done if you had been there that day? Then you pass around the back of that statue and you see recreated on the wall a big mural that's a reproduction of an 18th century painting based on eyewitness sketches of the British flotilla that attacked Manhattan on September 15th, 1776, the Battle of Kipps Bay. And this is, you know, if there are fans of the Broadway musical Hamilton, you know, one of the first songs there talks about 32,000 troops in New York Harbor. I mean, this was like, or to mix my metaphors for Star Wars fans out there, this is when the Death Star arrives. And so we want people to sort of see that, okay, it's great to cheer liberty and tear down the king, but
right, look
not,
at that flotilla.
The outcome was uncertain here. And so, yeah, so then you go through a sequence of galleries that looks at, gosh, what is the role of that little saving remnant of an army that Washington keeps with them, and the role that bold tactical and strategic moves like crossing the Delaware and attacking the Hessians at Trenton, the perseverance of the soldiers and women who accompanied them on the march. What is the role that alliances play? We pay some attention to the Oneida Indian Nation of New York, who were one of the few Native nations that actively sided with Continental Congress and helped to support the struggle for American independence. You know, later on, we'll explore how revolutionary governments and communities tried to put pressure on people, you know, not to be neutral, but you had to take an oath of allegiance. You had to actively support the revolutionary governments, or you might be driven to becoming a loyalist, for instance, or driven out of your community. I mean, it's a very complex story. It's not a simple narrative by any means. So we try to introduce you to kind of how different communities encountered the revolution and dealt with the very tough choices of living in the midst of this essentially civil war. It was an Anglo-American civil war in which the outcome was just so uncertain, and the potential cost of frankly joining the revolutionary side could have been, you know, the loss of your life and your property and family. And it's just such an incredible, rich story. As I said earlier, I mean, I just I have no taste for novels, because just truth is so much stranger than fiction.
No, exactly right. And I think from the story of the American Revolution, we could have about 100 blockbuster films based on the different characters.
Yes.
Really, you know, and to this point of how did this small group face this Death Star, as you rightly call it, of the Death Star of the day, the British Navy. And we won. And, you know, one of the central things, of course, there's many reasons why, but one of the central things, it seems to me, is the absolute courage and fortitude of George Washington, the leader of the Continental Army. That man had guts of steel, and how he persevered through the individual betrayal of, you know, one of his trusted lieutenants, Benedict Arnold, turning on him.
Yeah.
And the incredible odds that he faced, and yet he never wavered. He just kept going forward and trying his best, and ultimately winning. It's just, you know, he's got to be one of the great characters ever in humanity.
No doubt about it. And as you know, there's a lot of George Washington in the galleries, but the real sort of coda for most visitors' experiences is going in and seeing, you know, George Washington's command tent, what we call Washington's war tent, and seeing the film that accompany, you know, that presents it in a very, very dramatic fashion, and really explore, you know, why one of his biographers, I think, very rightly called him the indispensable man.
Right. Yeah, and we might have gotten by without any of the other individuals, although, you know, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Ben Franklin, all were very instrumental. But I think the only one who was truly indispensable was George Washington, that if he hadn't been who he was and did what he did, we would not have won.
No doubt about it, in my opinion.
So it's interesting, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, history, the past is gone, but really it isn't, and the past shapes who we are today. How do you think the American Revolution both reflected and shaped the American character of today?
Such a fantastic question. You know, I think that one of the things we're finding in talking with visitors today is how, you know, we're in a time in which it's no controversial statement to say we're a very divided nation at the moment. And looking, you know, casting our eyes back through almost 250 years of our nation's history, you know, we can look at how, because we're a nation that is based on a few founding ideas as opposed to a common language, you know, a common religion, a common race, a common country of origin, that the glue that holds us together is that sort of founding history, those founding ideas. Those are the touchstones that we always go back to get ourselves through times of great, you know, great strife and struggle. And they're responsible for getting us through those moments, for some of our, you know, both our highest and achievements as a people and through those low moments. And we're having some incredible conversations, you know, with people realizing that, you know, a lot of those issues in the American Revolution, you know, have not gone away. I mean, the questions of you know, liberty versus security. I mean, that takes you back to the 1760s and and the need for security, and you have to pay for security, and yet individual liberty is so important, and how do you make those balances? Of course, you know, the fact that there were, you know, a significant portion of the inhabitants of the British colonies, the fledgling United States, were enslaved, and that is a question which it took the loss of another 700,000 people and nearly a century to resolve. You know, that wasn't actually ultimately completed. It's still work that is ongoing. In fact, just yesterday, many listeners will remember an important civil rights photograph that was from a Memphis, you know, union that was striking, and it was African American men holding placards that said "I am a man," and the photographer actually, who took that as a 20-year-old college student in the period, just visited the museum because we've incorporated that into a mural here at the museum, and we had a wonderful opportunity to, you know, sort of meet him and take his picture with his work and chat with him a little bit. And so, you know, 250 years isn't actually that long, and the ripples of that of the creation of the nation and the issues that, you know, both were resolved and not resolved are certainly still with us here today.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's also interesting to me, if you look at both the United States and then north up at Canada, which was also, you know, there were British colonists up there, that we rebelled and fought for independence and the Canadians did not. And
they like to remind us of that, yes.
That we, it kind of gave that, it was both an expression and a reflection of that American real devotion to independence and freedom, and that, you know, we didn't want a foreign power or foreign people telling us what to do or how to live, that we wanted to shape our own destiny. And I think you can see that in the different personalities in the countries even today.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Now, you mentioned the Oneida, and we had an entire room devoted to the role of the Native Americans in the Revolution, which I really loved. Mm-hmm. You gave, you know, the real debates and the voices of the Native Americans, what they were trying to figure out, because some of the, you know, the tribes were split. Some backed the British, some backed the American colonists, and some stayed neutral. But I love that you told the that whole side of the story, which tends to not be represented much. And I love the story of the Oneida that carried food for hundreds of miles to feed George Washington and the American troops when they were near starvation at Valley Forge. So that's a thank you for including that piece of the story.
Absolutely. No, it's been a wonderful partnership. The Oneida Indian Nation, which of course is part of the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Confederacy in New York State, that was a league of six nations that had formed before European contact, and their strength had been in the unity between those groups and the fact that they would not fight one another. They had this very strong alliance. But like many other communities, the American Revolution forced them to to change sides. And it actually, there was a kind of civil war within the Anglo-American Civil War there that divided the Confederacy and the United Nation, members of whom, you know, still live on their ancestral lands in central New York, and part of the Tuscarora Nation, chose to side with the United States. So yeah, it's a very important and largely unknown aspect of the story.
Right. So we're just at our time here, but how can our listeners learn more about the museum? And by the way, listeners, I encourage you, put this on your bucket list, get yourself to Philadelphia and go see the Museum of the American Revolution. Do you have a website people can go to?
You bet we do. It's amrev, and museum. .org. So amrevmuseum.org, or if you just in your search box put Museum of the American Revolution Philadelphia, you'll certainly get our website, and we would absolutely love to welcome any of your visitors here to Philadelphia to see the museum.
Fantastic. And next time I come, I'll take you out to the City Tavern.
I would love it. You let me buy.
All righty, that's all the time we have. Dr. Scott Stevenson, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your amazing masterpiece of a museum.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Our next guest is Dr. Colonel Gloria Sanders.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've had an amazing career, and first I want to thank you for all you've done for America and for our veterans. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
How did you become interested in the military, and why did you choose the U.S. Army in particular to join?
Well, my first internship as a student at the Medical College of Virginia was at Walter Reed Army Hospital, and since most of your listeners probably were not alive then, I'd like to just mention a few statistics to refresh everyone's memory. There were over 58,000 American deaths in Vietnam, and over 38,000 of those were Army. The average age at death was 23.
Oh, that's
over
awful.
Over 150,000 were wounded. Of those wounded, over 5,000 had lost limbs. They were amputees. And over 1,000 of those amputees had multiple amputations. So here I am, a 20-year-old going to Walter Reed and seeing all this devastation with people my own age. And I wanted to describe the dirty ward. There were double doors. You opened the double doors, and there
just
are
to be
50
clear,
beds.
You're talking about the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., back during the Vietnam War, like in
Vietnam,
the 1960s.
That's correct.
Yep.
You opened the double doors into the dirty ward at Walter Reed. There are 25 beds down the right wall, 25 beds down the left wall, and nobody in the room has four extremities. And they are in Walter Reed Hospital about 10 days after they were injured in Vietnam. And, of course, we said the average age is 23, which means a lot of them were younger than that. After they were put in the dirty ward and their wounds were dirty, and that's why it was called the dirty ward, they later would take them to surgery and perform surgery to close the wounds and create a limb that was adequate for a prosthesis. Then there was the clean ward, another 50 beds. Same thing, young people, everyone in that ward was missing an extremity or more, one or more extremities. Then there was the rehab part. So my point is there were hundreds of amputees at Walter Reed at any one moment, and they were people my own age. So you can imagine the impact on a kid from a farm in eastern North Carolina seeing this as my first clinical exposure. It was profound.
Yeah, that must have been just horrendous to see that amount of damage to people. And for our listeners who may not know, Walter Reed Hospital has been in Washington, D.C. It was the Army's flagship medical center for over a century, from 1909 to 2011, and just closed about 6 years ago. And we're going to get to that, like why it was closed. But so this is the situation now of you, age 23, facing all these wounded Vietnam veterans at the hospital. You know, that must have been very hard emotionally on you.
Well, it was stimulating but difficult. I mean, I saw things there in volume that most therapists might see one case in a lifetime, a whole career. So as a student, it was fabulous.
Yeah, a lot of work to be done.
It was profound, yes.
Yeah. So being on this ward, then you wanted to do more to help the people there.
Well, I became so interested in amputations, first of all. And, of course, that wasn't the only major diagnosis. Head injuries was another huge diagnosis. There was a whole ward just to treat people with head injuries. There were so many of those. So the volume was incredible. It was incredible.
And then you came back to Walter Reed when we had the Iraq War and Desert Storm, 1990-1991. So you're now coming back after having, you know, gotten more training, more education. You yourself were a professor teaching physical therapy and prosthetics. Now you're coming back maybe 25 years later. What did you experience at Walter Reed Hospital during Desert Storm? Was it similar quality care?
I was on active duty. I was a lieutenant colonel then. And the two experiences were incredibly different. The Walter Reed of 1966 was the top of the line medical care. The building was so clean you could have eaten off of the floor, I tell people. They had literal white glove inspections. They came in physical therapy with white gloves on, checking for dust. When I went back to Walter Reed in 1991, the hospital was filthy. The people, the receptionist in physical therapy was so rude to patients. I walked up and told her, I said, if you were working in my clinic in North Carolina, you would be fired today and out the door. No one did anything. The prosthetic devices that were being used in 1990 were the things that we used in the 50s and 60s. The prosthetist who worked there was a civilian. New prosthetic devices came out in 1985, and from that forward, things made of graphite. People could jump and run, and wonderful devices. Walter Reed wasn't using any of them. So I told them, you can't do this. You must use the best that we have for our veterans, our military people who are coming in here. They banned me from the amputee clinic.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had been a guest speaker to their physical medicine residents there and to their staff, and they didn't want to hear it.
Wow, that's amazing.
The hospital was dirty. They were not up to date. Prosthetics was terrible. The Whirlpool room where you treat wounds was not ready for mass injury. Entirely different place.
And what do you think happened over that 25 years where Walter Reed, from kind of the top of medical care, then when you came back, Desert Storm, 1990-91, it was in terrible shape. Why was it let to run down like that?
I don't know if it was the leadership. If I'd been chief therapist there, I would have whipped a few things into place. I don't know if it was privatizing so much. The military was cut back a lot over the years. Military used to take care of everything. They cleaned the grounds. They cleaned the hospital. They did everything. And when you privatize, then the military head does not necessarily have imminent control over civilians. So that could be a reason. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just attitude could be a reason.
Yeah.
There
well,
was a huge
and
difference.
We do know that in 2011, Walter Reed was closed. Did it continue to kind of decline in quality to the point where they had to close it because it was so bad?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, and I should say Walter Reed is right in my neighborhood. I live about 1 mile away from Walter Reed, and they're now in the process of really, like, just knocking out all those buildings there.
Yeah.
It's just such
and
a shame.
And it was the best that the Army had. I remember asking the chief of my Army Reserve unit, who was a doctor. He was head of surgery at East Carolina University at the time. And I asked him, I said, how far behind a major hospital, teaching hospital, do you think Walter Reed is? This was 1990. Compared to Duke University Hospital or UNC Chapel Hill Hospital, he said 15 to 20 years behind.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you now yourself live near two military bases, Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point Marine Corps Base in North Carolina. How is the medical care there today for veterans in your area?
Well, if I speak in generalities, I don't think that will be quite as profound as if I give you a case study, sort of, and so people can hear specifics. So if I may, this patient went to the VA clinic in August of 2015 complaining of pain in his Achilles tendon, which is at the heel. 6 months later, he was sent for an X-ray. But he wasn't sent for an X-ray here in our county, where we have a civilian hospital, we have a naval hospital, and multiple places that people can, imaging centers and places where people can have X-rays. He was sent all the way to Wilmington, North Carolina, which is 60 miles one way, and this is a frequent problem. He was referred to my clinic in June. So that's 4 months after his X-rays were taken.
And your clinic now?
I asked to see his X-rays.
Where
he was still complaining of pain in his heel.
So where is your clinic now?
He got his X-ray disc, and I read it a few days later. I'm not going to tell you the profanity that I used over the...
but where? Tell us where your clinic is now. Are you at an Army clinic or are you at a university clinic?
It's a private outpatient clinic, but it's in the same county as the Camp Lejeune Naval Hospital, and I'm in the same county as Camp Lejeune Marine Corps Base.
Okay, and so what did you see with this patient?
Well, when I looked at his X-ray, I saw a fracture. A big chunk of bone had been pulled off of the heel bone. And the importance of that is that if this chunk of bone is only pulled away a few millimeters, it's possible for it to heal without surgery. It can bridge the gap. If it's pulled away too far, then it can't bridge the gap, and one would have to have surgery to push the chunk of bone back where it came from and screw it back in so it could heal that way. So there's a clinical significance here, and that it needed to be managed properly from the beginning. I was reading the February X-ray in the month of June. So I got the report that the doctor had, the radiologist had written, for this fracture, and this is a person who is employed by the VA system, and he said there were no fractures. I sent the X-ray to an orthopedic surgeon who was on the faculty at Duke, and he confirmed what I saw. So I was so upset by this, I reported it in three different people. I called the local clinic that had never contacted him about his X-rays in 4 months and complained. I called the head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is over the VA clinics in our county. And I called the local congressman's office. These were the responses. The local VA clinic called the patient. They never talked to me. and told him I was not a radiology doctor and I should not have told him that he had a fracture. The head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville said, and I must say in a very diminutive voice, this radiologist is really not one of ours. We contract with him, and maybe we need to have a peer review. And the local congressman's office said, I sent the entire report with the x-rays and everything. They said, well, let's wait and see what Trump does.
Oh, this is disgraceful. And
it
meanwhile, here's a
and
patient.
And if this was a civilian case, it would be a lawsuit. I would love to be the lawyer on that.
Is it possible for a military
patient
to bring a lawsuit?
Gloria, this person didn't hear about their x-rays in 6 months. I had an MRI done a year ago and have never heard anything.
Wow. And what year are we talking about? Are we talking about, like, this is within the past year or so?
Yes, yes, this year.
Because we've been hearing, you know, there was a lot of there was a lot of discussion of how the veterans' care and the VA was, you know, subpar and long waiting lists and not great treatment, but then people were supposed to be on it and fixing it up and cleaning it up and they're saying that it's in better shape now, but you're saying this is now present-day situation where there's this kind of very poor quality, even negligent medical care happening in our VA for our veterans.
It is awful. It is just terrible.
And are these isolated incidences?
Of these people. They get so upset, and they thought, you know, I go to war for my country, and I come back, and this is how I'm treated. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, they're just distraught over it. And I wanted to tell you, this is, I have a newspaper in front of me, our local newspaper, the Daily News from Jacksonville, North Carolina. The date is Tuesday, April the 18th, 2017, last week. Here's the headline. Veteran accused of assaulting doctor over alleged lack of adequate treatment. That was in one of these local clinics right here in this county.
Really? What's the date on that?
Last week.
Oh, my goodness.
April the 18th, 2017.
Wow, so the level of treatment is so bad that the veteran is attacking the doctor because they're so frustrated.
Enraged. Yes, yes.
And how widespread are these some isolated incidences, you know, a few kind of missteps, or do you see this as something that's very widespread and kind of endemic to the Veterans Administration even today?
Well, I just had my 50th class reunion at the Medical College of Virginia, and one of my classmates who's worked at Tufts for 35 years in Boston, she said, Gloria, our veterans get good care. Well, Boston has some of the best medicine in our country.
I'm happy to hear
that's probably true. You're from Boston.
Yeah, we're very proud of our medical care in Boston.
That's right. But all I can speak to is what they're receiving here. I don't know if it's nationwide, but I suspect that it is. I think it's a little better and a little worse here and there, but they're treated so disrespectfully.
This is really heartbreaking and infuriating that our veterans who put their lives on their line for defending our country, and then they have some kind of disease or medical condition they need help with, and they're not getting proper treatment, and they're being disrespected. This is outrageous.
Who should get the best medical care that our government has to offer?
Our veterans and our mothers.
Any group of people, over the congressmen, over the senators.
Yep. Well, what's really disturbing about what you're saying, in addition to the terrible care and the disrespect of our noble veterans, is that when you raise a concern about a particular case to the head of the VA down there and to the member of Congress, that they were kind of blasé about it and not taking the action that's needed to correct the situation.
Absolutely. And I've told people this. When I made the call to the head of the VA hospital in Fayetteville, if this person had said, "Thank you so much for telling me about this. This is not acceptable on my watch. I will take care of it, and I will be back with you."
Exactly.
That wasn't what I heard.
Right. No, exactly, because any medical system, any human organization, really, there's problems will happen, and people
sure.
make mistakes. But the key is when it's brought to your attention that who's ever in charge just takes responsibility and takes action to fix the problem.
Right. I didn't hear that. And no, first of all, when I called, it was a week later that I got a return phone call, and my first call I said, "This is a lawsuit. This is terrible."
Mm-hmm.
And then I told the case. And a week later I got a phone call, and since then I've never gotten a follow-up call of any corrective action.
Is it at all possible for a military veteran to bring a lawsuit against the VA for the treatment?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But I'm
yeah.
not positive.
Yeah, well, you know, probably not, else there'd probably be a slew of lawsuits right now.
Right. I think you're right about that.
So what can we do about this? You know, as citizens, our listeners are very active and informed members of our communities and our country. What can we do to help improve the care for our veterans?
Well, I think it has to come from the top. I think they have to be given authority to fire people when they need to. I've been told that you can't fire somebody that's working at a VA facility.
Uh-huh.
Well, then that breeds complacency.
Uh-huh.
So somebody has to have authority and use it.
Right.
People will normally rise to the level that you ask and demand.
Uh-huh.
I found that in my own private practice. But if you get slack, they get slack. And if they know they can get away with something, they do. I guess it's human nature for
uh-huh.
most people, not all people.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people have their own internal barometer, and they're always going to do a great job.
Right.
But and maybe that's one of the downfalls of, quote, socialized medicine, when people don't have choices. But I fear, I heard recently that Trump just signed something that veterans can go to doctors of their own choice. Well, that sounds great, except are they going to pay properly and promptly? And I wanted to give an example. Provider. I'm a healthcare provider. I have had a clinic here for 32 years.
Just before you go into that, I want to hear that about that experience as a provider, but just on your comment about the, you know, lack of choice and but bear in mind that was also true in during the Vietnam War, is medical care provided, and there was no choice. You went to the Veterans Administration, but it was really quality care there. Walter Reed was like fantastic, passing the white glove test, literally. You know, something changed and something happened. So that's what we need to find is, like, where was that change and how do we fix this? So go ahead. Tell us the story of you as a provider. What's happening in some of your cases here?
Okay. Day before yesterday, I walk in my clinic, and my employee is on hold with her private cell phone. And I said, "Well, what are you holding for?" She said, "The Veterans Choice Program." And I said, "How long have you been holding to talk with someone?" She said, "Well, over an hour now."
And what is the
Veterans
Choice?
And 1 hour and 20 minutes, someone answered the phone. She told me later that they usually have to hold between 3 and 4 hours to even speak with somebody about non-payment for care that we gave months ago. And if you have 7 visits that you need to discuss with the person that you get on the phone, you're only allowed to talk to them about 3 visits. and then you have to hang up and call back and wait another 3 to 4 hours to talk about the next 3 visits, and then you have to hang up and call back to talk about the 7th visit.
Wow, and explain for our listeners, what is Veterans Choice?
It's one of the multiple options for veterans, and it's something sort of new. I'm not sure about the who qualifies for which type of veterans care. I can't answer that.
But it's basically a program for veterans to call and get medical attention.
Yes, at civilian clinics. That's correct.
Yeah, and they're having now to wait, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 hours just to get someone on the phone.
And what providers are going to put up with that? You know, if you've got a really good doctor who's extremely busy seeing patients at Duke University, are they going to put up with having to wait 3 and 4 hours to discuss a claim? It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I called my congressman's office that same day. They already knew about it. They've had lots of complaints about it. He could tell me everything I was getting ready to say. He said it for me. I said, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And you can't get an answer. Who has the authority to do something?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's obvious. I don't know if the congressmen don't have the authority. I don't know the system.
Yeah.
I just know that it's bad.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like something that should be brought to the attention to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And the head of the VA, the new head of the VA, needs to be briefed on all of this. And it all can be fixed. It just has to... You have to lay down the law.
Right. I think we should put you in charge.
Hold to it. And if people don't step up, then pack your bags. Go home.
Yeah. I'd love to put you in charge of the VA and clean. That place will be cleaned up in no time.
When I called the first time about this one case and sent the report to my local congressman, I said that. I said, put me in charge of these VA clinics in Onslow County. I said, heads will roll, or it will improve.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah, somebody's got to. People
right,
are so
exactly.
mealy mouth about things and don't want to upset the apple cart. And, oh, I've just got this many more years and months to retirement, so I'm not going to say anything. And
right. That's a bad attitude. And,
horrible.
I so appreciate your service over 50 years, both in the military yourself and helping our veterans with their medical care. And by the way, congratulations on your recent Lifetime Achievement Award from the Medical College of Virginia. That's a big deal, and I congratulate you. So we're just about wrapping here. If you had a very brief comment to make as we're closing out, that would be great.
Well, I think the lack of good care for our veterans is a national tragedy. I think it's a poor testament to the heart and soul of this country. Every congressman, every congresswoman, and senator should be ashamed. What is this government thinking to treat these people so badly? In my opinion, they're getting third world country level care and with personal abuse. I am sick of seeing it as a military officer, and it breaks my heart.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate what you're doing, and we're going to try to get more attention on this issue and get some action. That's all the time we have. Colonel Dr. Gloria Sanders, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.